Welcome to the 40K Lorecast.
Welcome to 40K Lorecast with me, John Barsotti, and Brad Chester.
This guy.
Today, we'll be finalizing our coverage of the 500 World Campaign with a dive into the last little bit. I mean, well, yeah, for now, whatever. Who knows what GW is doing with any of this stuff anyway. But 40K Lorecast, weekly show on the lore of the Warhammer 40K universe, releasing every Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern. Please like, comment, mostly just comment. That's what's awesome. I enjoy reading them and they're fun. So thank you all for doing that. It helps our algorithm, spreads us to more people. And yeah, show notes have a lot of links in it. First is our YouTube channel where we have our bi-monthly-ish Q&As. We were a little late in the last one, but someone couldn't stop getting surgery. So, you know.
I mean, it's not my fault.
like the Pokemon collector of back surgery. But yeah.
Look, so you got to catch them all, baby.
Exactly. But also a link to our other show, The History of 40K. And if you want to support us, a link to our merchandise and, of course, our Patreon. Our Patreon is really simple. It's how we fund a lot of our show. It's what allows us to expand areas. Some of them have been failures, guys. I apologize. We had good ideas and turns out poor execution. But with the Patreon, $4.99 gets you this show and the History of 40K, completely ad-free, or 8.32 New Zealand dollars. Sorry in advance for how bad I'm going to mangle these names. But New Plymouth, lazy naming mechanic there for the record, is the sunniest spot in all of New Zealand, boasting 2,592 hours of sunshine a year. So they average 7 hours of sunshine a day, which is not half bad. I would kill for that living where I live currently in Michigan. Actually kill for that.
I'm jumping in on this, John, because Did you know that the New Zealand dollar or Kiwi got introduced July 10th, 1967, replacing the New Zealand pound. Strong.
That's how much they hated the Queen. They were like, we're just changing it to dollar. Like, that's just lazy. I like it, though. Like, no, screw you guys and your stupid colonialism. I support it. All right. But New Plymouth looks at Mount Taranaki. Taranaki, anyway, which is a volcano that compares itself to Mount Fuji, but the surroundings way better. Mount Fuji's got all those cherry blossoms. This one actually looks pretty and it's cool as hell. And if you like puns, New Plymouth is for you, because New Plymouth has a beautiful coastal path, a giant park, temperate weather, and it's situated in the region called Taranaki. So they call it the paradise of New Zealand. Get it? Yeah.
Welcome to paradise.
Yeah. Groan all you want. I've heard way worse from way shittier places. Also, boo your rugby team. Boo. As I will take one swing at the New Zealanders because I root for the box. So boo. Anyway, but we do have a Discord too. So if you want to come yell at me about that, join it. Come on to the Discord and explain to me all the reasons why I'm wrong about rooting for the Springboks or whatever however I just pronounced so much of that wrong. Link in the note to the Discord. Come on in. 12,000 plus people now. Great spot. Honestly, just go to Ask John and Brad if you have any opinions, and I respond. Just candidly, it's where I am. But it's also stuff for literature recommendation, gameplay, memes, general chat. It's a really great spot for people, especially who are like newer to the lore or trying to get going. We have a lot of veterans in there who are really great at sharing their experience, their knowledge. One of my favorite things people ask in there is, hey, I read such and such. I liked it. Is there anything else like this? You will get a sea of answers. And it's really a great way for you to not have to read one of the crappy Black Library books. Because, you know, out of like 450, there is some duds. But with that, on to the cast. Let's start off with Titus taking the L. At the end of our last cast, Titus and crew took a pretty big loss.
Well, the crew took a loss. The casualties were from, hey, has your name showed up in this book so far? You're probably not going to make it, buddy.
Yeah, it was basically every red-shirted Ultramarine died.
But I like
phasers this, were not set to stun.
Yes. But for a real reason, as opposed to, I like this quite a bit in the writing, because a lot of times Marines take an L just to set up a bigger victory. But this wasn't an L just to set up a bigger victory. It was actually part of an actual plan to figure out what the Marines actually knew, how they would react. And I like this quite a bit in this.
Yeah, you are right. So let's talk about what happened. So
come on, give it some mojo.
It's fine. Let me put it this way. The story of what happened, great. The fact that they just murdered they redshirted all of these Space Marines are like, oh, yeah. I mean, it was nonstop rear guard action after rear guard action from Space Marine. Some of them didn't get named. They were lazy. Like, they were like, oh, yeah. And then another squad did a rear guard action because they were like, we're not even bothering giving him. He didn't earn a name in this story.
He didn't earn a name.
No.
However, have a lot of heroic rear guard actions.
Yeah. I think one of the dreadnoughts died. It was a thing. All right. But the whole reason behind this was it was actually not pure chance that Titus and the group were overwhelmed by Amantar's forces. It was actually totally a plan by one of Amantar's leaders, Nemesar Anutek. Anutek? And whatever.
Anutek, actually.
Is it Anutek? You're
100%, yeah, it's Anutek.
I'm 100% right. How do you know?
I know things.
Okay.
So I also...
We're both confident people. I just love... confidence with you said you pronounced that correctly, and I know you, and we both were guessing our pronunciation.
Actually, for a change, occasionally I do go on the internet and get the pronunciation. So if the internet says you're correct, by the way, or at least Google did.
Oh, good. That's what a reliable source.
The internet has never been wrong, John. Not once.
God, I'm actually of the age where we weren't allowed to cite the internet in college. And now it's like all you cite. Like, I remember that you couldn't cite. Oh, you're right. When I had to write my thesis, I was not allowed to cite anything from the internet.
I do like
when
you do try to.
I'm that
old. Sorry, everybody that likes Wiki, but there's a reason you can't cite Wiki. I love when somebody cites Wiki on something. I'll just go in and change the Wiki.
Oh, there's nothing better when people change Wikis. All right. But back to Anutek. So Anutek calculated that the humans knew about the phasing capabilities of the Necrons. And she knew that they would do whatever they could do to shut down the Necron's ability to bring in reinforcements. Thus, by making it appear like the main facility was less protected, they would have no choice but to attack it. And she did by making it appear like it hadn't come online yet. This way, they had no choice but to go and attack it, which, you know, kind of was true.
It wasn't completely untrue. They just had a civil war with Sawtek like 5 minutes before this. So. Right.
And what she was doing was basically once they'd invaded, what they did was they looked around and said, all right, we can conquer this planet, but these guys in blue armor are a problem. And the problem was that it wasn't that the Necrons couldn't defeat the Ultramarines, because they could. They could just keep warping in more and more guys, phasing in more and more Necrons. But the concern they had was the Ultramarines could hold out. And the longer they held out, they brought in more people. And eventually this became just an endless struggle. So the idea was, well, why don't we just trap them, kill all the Ultramarines? You should know what they were called, obviously. And then we're off the races. However, with all the calculations, she forgot one thing, which is the thickness of ultramarine plot armor.
Plot armor. I was just about to say that. Plot armor is so thick. You got to give the speech about the Uruk-hai on that. Your armor is thick.
Yeah. It's like fighting a land war in Asia. You just don't do these
just
things.
Just don't do it. One of the other parts of the plan, too, was they want to win, but also they're not just in it to kill Marines. They wanted the shard of the Nightbringer. That's
the whole thing. They have to go get that. And so Titus succeeds. He's able to get back and he returns to the main base, which is called Abstinus Bastion. And he finds when he gets back there, the Necrons are in a full court press upon the Imperium. Every single front, there's an attack. Locust skirmers are attacking the outlying areas. Scarabs and wraiths are devastating the lower lying settlements. Regimental soldiers being slaughtered by Nightbringers, plural. Which, by the way, were described as a towering abomination with black robes and a scythe that would turn living beings to dust just with its presence. So, you know, guardsmen were doing great.
As usual, regiments were getting thrown into the wood chipper.
Yep. And so Titus looks around and realizes that it's untenable. And he calls for aid from Ultramar. And because they're Ultramarines, he actually does get a response. The response is yes. The fourth company comes back.
He fires up. Come on now. Yeah, there's so many references he can make. He put up the fires of Gondor. Come on. Yeah.
Well, no, but he doesn't, though, because the thing is, the Ultramarines have to do that. That's what, like, the other, like, lesser chapters have to do. They have to do something
lesser
epic.
Lesser chapters.
Yeah. The Ultramarines just put out a phone call, a text to the group chat saying, hey, can someone help me move this weekend? And, like, four people come back with, yeah, man, I got you, because we're Ultramarines. We're reliable and helpful. So...
I want to do something real quick on this one, because this is one of the first times in the lore that I've really felt that the Necrons were an actual menace, because for almost the entirety of the lore of 40K, Necrons have always been this sinister robotic force that was doing something, but they were never.
They always got defeated. The truth is, the Necrons always get defeated in the lore up until 500 worlds, even in the whatever the one we covered, not Indominus. Is it Indominus?
It's the Praia Nexus.
Right. Yeah, because even the Praia Nexus area, like the Necrons were pushing back, but the Imperial forces are still doing okay there. This is the first time I can think of where the Necrons really are beating up.
But they're also using a full force. You're feeling the force of a dynasty coming at you, because we've had so much of the Necrons just being, we're fighting amongst ourselves. We'll occasionally beat these guys, but we don't really care because they never thought that they were a real fight almost. This is the first time that I felt the Necrons were actually pushing to conquer and actually win. And it felt like, ooh, this is a actual threat to the galaxy now.
Completely. And now the next bit we're going to cover here, guys, we're going to get into something where two or three things all happen at the exact same time. So it's going to sound like we're kind of time warping a little bit. This is very well written, especially for a short story. So while these Necrons are pushing in, Titus takes a moment, actually literally meditates, and decides to, not in a hippie sense, but in a, hey, let me make sure I'm making the right decisions. He looks around, and the thing he realizes is, remember, he was Death Watch. He knows that the markings in the Necrons are, something was off about them. When he went into the spaceship and killed everyone there and took the shard, everyone had the markings of the Saltek dynasty on them. But when he went into the complex to bomb it, it was different. The guys have a different markings. The ones lying on the ground were Saltek, but these ones are actually which ones these are.
They had three different, is what they had there.
And so he's noticing that they all have different markings, which is odd. That's not something Necrons do. They don't cross support.
They don't work together at all.
In addition, he started noticing some odd behaviors from them. Necron warriors are very rigid. They walk in a straight line. They fight like Revolutionary War or Civil War soldiers. Shoulder to shoulder, fire all the guns, deal with it concept. They never break formation. These ones do. They constantly actually break formation where they would run off chasing like random retreating soldiers, like down alleyways, that kind of stuff, which is like, just, they don't do that. And Titus doesn't know about the Destroyer Curse, obviously, because no one knows about the Destroyer Curse outside of the Necrons. But this is the first time where we see another race becoming aware that something's off within the Necrons. And he begins to figure out he has to do something. Maybe this is a way for him to exploit this. Now, on that note, back to the Necrons. Sorry about the Transformers jump, guys. If you don't get that reference, congratulations. You didn't watch Transformers in the 80s and get ADHD with the rest of us. God, those cuts were brutal. Anyway.
Starscream.
It's just, go watch. It's like 5 seconds of animation, then cut. And I realized it was just me like staring at a television going like, the ADHD, that's genetic, but man, that show didn't help. That's all I'm getting. So as we talked about last time, the Destroyer Curse will turn a Necron into a being just obsessed with killing, like an uncontrollable urge. But Antar and his leaders appear to be able to control it to a point where they're still able to possess modicums of strategy. And this gets explained really well in the 500 Worlds campaign, that he has these generals who work underneath him, for lack of a better phrase, and they're able to actually control their behavior. But it's a lot more like a Doctor Strangelove type thing, which, again, if you don't get that reference, deal with it. Sorry, it's a great movie.
Yeah, so Avatar himself is a big dude because of the fact that I think that, again, Brad fucking theory is that he... He might be the beginning of it, but I think he is definitely a carrier of the destroyer curse.
Oh, he is.
Put it on others, but it feels like he can give you a level of destroyer curse.
I'm torn on this. So the way it's almost described is similar to a Nurgle plague, where Amon-Tar moves around with this thing surrounding him, and it will infect you, but you have to give yourself over to it, is how it feels like. Because they talk about this, that some beings he'll just conquer instantly, but it feels like it's the warriors who don't really have free will, but the upper beings do have some semblance of free will.
Sure, but it still feels like he's giving them a different version almost, you know, because some of them go immediately and then they kind of lets him loose like a rabid dog, and then there's others that are just infected, but they just feel a need and they don't really change. They just have
My thinking on it was maybe the ones who are in his court, maybe those were overlords that he was able to grab. That was my assumption, but I could see it also being maybe he's choosing them. I hadn't thought of it that way.
He's choosing
you. You could totally be right. Yeah, my brain was, oh, there's overlords, but you're right. It could just be he's actually going through like, no, I like this one. Here, you get a happy version. So yeah. So in effect, with Amon-Tar, he now has, the important part of it, he has his own dynasty, like spread throughout the galaxy dynasty. And it's ever increasing because he's the destroyer curse. So as the destroyer curse spreads and more the tomb worlds fall to it, more join his legion. And the size and scope of this is impossible to figure out how big it is, but it's also impossible to control. So Amon-Tar, he built almost his own triarchy. The Necrons have a triarchy. He basically built his own to rule it. And this one, what Brad was talking about, is the generals who work under Amon-Tar actually keep a traditional Necron title of Nemesor, which is it's common. It's almost like general. It's not an overlord. It's not a lord. It's a high rank. I think actually might be above overlord now I think about it, but whatever. Now, these ones have an important function. And the reason their function is that as this legion is spread throughout the galaxy, Amon-Tar isn't Gaz. He can't just influence the Necrons all over the place. So he has to spread himself throughout. So he has these Nemesars all over the place who are doing destroyer cult stuff here and there. And that's important because these ones, in order to do this, though, they can't just be mindless thralls obsessed with killing all organic life, because that's actually pretty easy to put down. They have to be able to maintain some level of lucid thought and some level of function. So the whole concept around them, this is a big piece, because the idea around the Cursed Legion up to this point within the Necrons is that these are all mindless thralls. In fact, the Silent King still thinks that all of the Cursed Legion are mindless, but we've now learned they're not. In fact, they are strategic. They do have plans. And so this actually changes. We're going to talk more about this at the end of the cast. This has a much bigger effect on what can happen with the Necrons, because the Silent King, for example, is banking on that I'll just wipe these guys out whenever I need to. And it's going to be a lot harder than you think.
Also, again, still, him and the Triarchs gave the title to Amon-Tar.
Yeah, probably. Something's going on. There's a lot GW can do with this. But the reason we bring all that up is because that's kind of important for what happens next. Back on Nova Magnar, after Titus and his crew leave and escape, there's a moment of clarity. Amon-Tar is furious about their escape, but realizes that it doesn't really matter in the grand scheme. The Cursed Legion is on Nova Magnar for one reason and one reason only, and that is to get the Shard of the Nightbringer. They succeeded in their sneak attack on the Sautek Dynasty, which was called Uzhmek by the Necrons. They arrived before the tomb fully awakened, and they overwhelmed the defenders. But the overlord, whose name was Haskatepef.
You're not even trying, John.
It is Haskatef. Whatever. Ted. So Overlord Ted was awoken suddenly in an emergency And as soon as he woke up, took a look around and went, nope. Grabbed the C-10 shard and hit the leave button on the spaceship and bailed out. Successfully fled all of the chasing Necrons and found himself staring right at Titus.
This is one of my favorites because this guy's like, I got it. It's one of those, you know, movie scenes or whatever, when somebody's getting away, it's always one of the bad guys, you know, where they're leaving the rest of the good guys for it, and then turns around and sees the alien, the mummy, the whatever, right in front of him. That was
it's
Titus.
The alien sits up in the back seat while he's driving away. That's what this was. It's like, oh, I escaped. And Titus went, the hell you did. Boom. So Amintar now can sense that the shard is back on Nova Magnor. Actually, he knows exactly where it is. Sense it. And he has a situation. After the failure against the Ultramarines, though, he needs to be better prepared this time. Against the Ultramarines, to be fair, he laid a very good trap. Very, very good trap. And they escaped. So he decides this time, nope, we're going to do surprise and overwhelming force. And he looks around, and I love this plan, by the way. He goes, because it's kind of like the Pirates of the Caribbean thing of like, I'll just go under, but on a much grander scale.
See, for a change, I'm even getting me mad. The usual thing that you usually complain about.
Oh, this part's hilariously stupid. Yeah. All right, let me do it and jump on it, because it is funny. So Antar discovers a fissure going, but it's through the earth, basically right up to where the ADMIC facility is, and goes, cool, and grabs, I don't know, 100,000 Necron warriors and starts going for a walk that way. But it's too far deep for the Imperium to see it, because of course it is.
Just shut up. Like, I just, come on, man.
And he, by the way, knew that their scanners couldn't go this deep. How? Who knows? Because it makes scanners. Sense.
It's a bunch of Marines with metal detectors walking on the beach. It's a bunch of
they ordered it online. Which, by the way, I learned this the other week. Did you know in Florida it's illegal metal detecting on the beach? I was in Florida a couple weeks ago, or at least where I was in Florida. So maybe a fancy bit. Weird. Fine. But random things you learn. So he basically decides to bring like over 50% of his forces to just go attack this ADMEC facility. So this is going to work. However, his whole plan relies on them not being detected. So in order to do this, he has a cunning plan. And actually, this actually is a cunning plan. He takes Nemesar Anutek, the one who thought of the idea of to attack Titus, and says, hey, take care of everything else. And basically told her, just attack the Imperials nonstop. Just constantly, whatever it is, just throw endless bodies at them, no matter what, all over the place. So because what you don't want to do is all of a sudden, like, if you're going to do a sneak attack, don't just stop attacking somewhere else, because then they actually might use their scanners and go, hey, I wonder if the Necrons are somewhere else.
I mean, we just fell for a trap 42 hours ago. So
yeah, because in all fairness, if like Titus had discovered where they were, like, all right, so do we just collapse the earth on them and then this isn't a problem anymore? Yeah, basically.
Pretty much.
Yeah. But when he does this, one cool little piece is that because he grabs so many Destroyer cult members together in this, like, it's almost an orc wah happens.
I say it's a wog.
Yeah. And then what happens?
There's a reason that his council is considered the Oblivion Council.
Yeah.
They're not exactly chill.
And what I like is as they go off, though, this actually has almost like a feedback effect through everybody else. And so Anutek has to actually work overdrive on herself to not fall into like the non-lucid state of the Destroyer cult. Because she has to sit there and actually couldn't direct, I don't know, a million Necrons all over the place. And she's having to fight it because with so much like anger and hate coming out of Amintar and all the other cursed Legion members, she's actually getting this almost like, again, orc wah. I have to be part of this too, which
was just going to rush off and murder people.
Yes. Yeah, so she instead of like organizing the defense, she's just like, I've got a stick, hit thing with stick. So it's, and that's going to be important in a little bit. But around the same time, back at HQ, Titus has a next move plan. And two things happen. First, he puts in a call to Archmagos Oct about the weapon that they recovered in orbit and gets nothing back. So Titus goes, cool, I'm going to go destroy that damn thing.
Which should have been as Titus, start learning from some of your mistakes, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Whenever there's a weird alien artifact, fire it into space. That's what you do every time, Titus. Every single time. That's the new system. Full stop. But
it was a good decision. However, he went down and went, oh, things are happening. How many things? All of them.
Yeah, it wasn't ideal. So out of nowhere, they get attacked. This is happening at the exact same time that Amantar is heading underground and Anutek launches her thing. So there is this massive coordinated assault on basically every single front.
It's supposed to be this wild attack. They're not trying to punch through. They're trying to take away the defenses from the Nightbringer Shard so that they have to basically leave and defend so many different places.
Yeah, it's effectively impossible for them to do all this stuff. So now Titus has to shift his focus from going and blowing up the shard to not having the entire planet fall. So he sends Gadriel and Mataris to the south and west to shore up defenses there, and another strike force north to deal with the Nightbringer, which was a cool story.
One of the good things, I like this a lot because the Ultramarines do it a lot, even though occasionally they're the good guys that are willing to let you die for a cause. They're very pragmatic about their defenses, and they even talk about this in this story here.
Yeah, that he goes,
this is winnable, this is winnable, this is winnable. We're sending forces there. They kind of went, what about the other places? He goes, I just said they're not winnable. Stop asking me dumb questions. And just went, I guess everybody dies there. Deuces.
Yep. Now, what I like next is there's a whole bit in the book, blah, 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 fight, blah, 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 victory, blah, 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 this. But there's an amazing homage to an old Necron rule that I thought was awesome they dumped in here. So while fighting the Necrons and the Nightbringer, the Ultramarines just cannot do anything to the Nightbringer. They're hitting it with everything. It's just bouncing off it, slaughtering everything. But all the Necron warriors around it, they are dying. And so they call in a Stormhawk interceptors to just say, all right, let's just strafe it and see if that works. And they come through, and the Stormhawks, again, do screw off nothing to the Nightbringer, but it kills almost all the warriors around it, which then all of a sudden in a blink, the Nightbringer disappears along with all the warriors, which is a great homage back to, was it third or fourth edition, Brad?
Both.
Yeah.
Their rule was so messed up because what would happen is that no matter how bad you were crushing, if your force ever got down to 20%, I think it was 25 actually, when it could be 20%.
I can't remember.
Yeah. 20 or 25%. If you got down to that exact number, and it was by number of models back then, the Necron force teleported away. The entire force. You instantly were gone.
Yeah. So everyone else had to be tabled. You had to kill every model on the board. Necrons, you just got down to 25% of model count, not points, model count, and they would disappear. So GW just dropped that out of nowhere. Oh, yeah, by the way, that's still a thing. Oh, my God, if they brought that back for 11th edition, I know so many people who would just cry.
Think about it. You'd have DBAs, Catan, the Nightbringer, the Silent King, and you'd go, yeah, I'm only targeting warriors and immortals.
And your army just teleports off the board. Oh, look, I won. Anyway, but yeah, so good job, GW, putting that in. All right. Gadriel and Mataris, they secure their fronts, but really secure at best. I mean, the Imperial forces are losing this battle. They are beset.
Go back to what I was throwing out before, though, too, which is they're beset on the fronts that are actually fightable. They've lost. The other fronts are just crushed.
Yeah, 100%.
Everybody's dead.
Yeah, everyone. Yeah, this is brutal. So Titus is looking around and going, all right, we've got two options. Option one, full retreat, exterminatus, or turn this thing back to an offensive. And he goes with option B because he's Titus. And Titus notices something. He notices the majority of the forces that are coming and fighting are coming out of Site Umbra, which is where the ambush had happened earlier. And he concludes that there must be dimensional portals there, bringing in the Necrons, which means the Necrons basically have infinite reinforcements there and that will eventually overwhelm the defenders. And he also concludes that the Necrons would have left the Vortex Bomb there and not destroyed it. And the only rational explanation for this is, I assume Ultramarine plot armor, because this is 100% Dr. Evil and laser sharks. Like, why would they get rid of the vortex bomb? Of course they wouldn't. The thing that could undermine their entire plan is probably sitting right there, I guarantee you, next to all of the teleportation, which, by the way, is exactly where it was. Exactly where it was. Yeah. This wasn't like, you read it, and I'll be honest, I groaned out loud when I read that. Like, oh, come on. No,
let me tell you why I groaned out loud. Because remember when they couldn't find the cataclysmic giant rift of fissure in the planet with a 500,000 Necron warriors and all their forces moving on? They immediately used their scanners and found a bomb.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Down. Yeah. There it is. It's right there. They haven't disassembled it. But again, Titus determines the best course of action is to deploy to this Site Obscurum, terrible name, which is somehow connected to Site Umbra through an underground tunnel, which, to Brad's point, they discovered. And we'll just fight our way there, secure the vortex bomb, blow it up, and save the planet. Problem solved. So he grabs Gadriel and the second company, and they head out to Site Obscurus. They do this lightning hawk thunder strike.
Thunderhawk assault,
blah,
baby.
Blah, 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 which actually is cool. Thunderhawks are awesome.
I want this in a future game because it does sound and look badass.
But they come jumping out of the airplane.
Yes, they come, literally.
Yeah.
Jumping out of an airplane.
Yeah, yes. It comes in at like full speed. The front bay opens and the plane just stops. They come rocketing out like chains sort of blazing and start cutting down Necrons. Yeah, it's badass.
It looks super awesome.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then they start fighting their way into the tomb complex.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
In my professional life, one thing I know well is how challenging managing a global team can be. Just the act of creating one has been extremely challenging over the years. Because the one thing you learn quickly is the difficulty of hiring global talent and how unclear the costs can be. It looks simple at first, then the fees start to stack up with compliance worries, contractors versus employees, and a host of other regulations. People brings clarity with upfront, all-in hiring costs and enables you to hire the world. People is an AI-powered human resource platform built for founders, HR leaders, and operators who are hiring and supporting teams around the world. People helps you hire, pay, and manage talent in over 185 countries with fast onboarding that can be done in minutes. Instead of juggling separate tools for contracts, payroll, benefits, and compliance, People brings everything together with built-in compliance and local expertise to support you. This is especially helpful if you're managing teams internationally or planning to grow. The fastest growing companies in the world use People to stay organized and reduce risk, and founders use it to scale faster without feeling like they need to become HR or compliance experts. Bottom line, it simplifies global people operation so you can spend more time growing the business and supporting your team. People's new standard discounted pricing is only $399 per month per employee. That helps you contain costs. Go to hipeble.ai to get a free estimate. That's hipeble.ai for a free estimate.
40K Lorecast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are all things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings may vary. Not available in all states or situations.
While this is happening, though, Archmagos Oct is losing his mind. Because the Necrons, when they put a Satan away, the password is not 12345, like on Brad's luggage. It's, come on.
I think you're going way too long on that. My password clearly would be 1234. That's too many numbers.
We'll go to 2. Who's going to guess it? 1, 2. They won't get that. Yeah. Yeah. All right. The cages that they built for the Satans were highly complex and well beyond the capabilities of Admech Magos. So Oct is basically staring at his god locked in a cage, and he cannot figure out the key. Luckily,
by this time, he's basically just slamming it on the ground.
And
just,
yeah, like, brr, like the files are in the computer. And so he's obsessed with opening this. But what happens is his mind starts to go around this time. And he's getting reports coming in from the rest of the planet saying...
He's, but back it up. His mind's not going because he's off. He's getting dominated by the Catan.
Yeah, it's hard to figure. It's weird. He's getting dominated by the Catan, but not in a way where he actually can help the Catan. It's just kind of almost shutting him down because he's getting...
Mass Effect style. It's basically Reaper...
Yeah,
you know what I mean,
well, but the Reapers would control you and make you do stuff.
But they weaken you first before they can take control. Yeah, it weakens
fair
you.
Point. Yeah, fair point. Yeah, he's just low. Which,
like, that's what I think is happening to him. He's just losing his mental defenses. Yeah.
And what I like about this is what happens next. Apparently, the Admechs do have scanners that work. And so he gets a bunch of calls coming in saying, hey, there's like a million Necrons walking towards us underground. Should we do something about that? And his response is just no response. Doesn't tell Imperial defenders, doesn't even increase his defenses. He just hangs out, which really sucks the Planetary Defense Force because Amintar and his force show up hard. Mostly to the dismay of the Planetary Defense Force. To be fair,
dismay. They died so fast they didn't have time to be dismayed.
What's funny about this is like Amintar's force was so big, they could have gone a frontal assault and ripped through these people. And instead they came from underneath, like, and behind. This blew for them. Because he pops up, starts attacking. They, of course, call for support. Titus is over on Site Obscurus with all of them. The Imperial fleet is, of course, suffering communication issues. No explanation. Just, you know, just atmospheric interference. Because, clouds. Yeah, of course there is. 41st millennia. Ah, it's cloudy today. And we can't get a message through. It's cloudy. It's really cloudy. Yeah, night fight. Right. So night fight's still the best. Guys... Although I do like, by the way, that at Adepticon, we're going to have Night Fight. You and I are playing. It's actually in the packet.
The doubles.
In the packet for doubles is Night Fight. Night Fight's back. So
it's game three.
Yeah. I say we just bring an all melee army just so we don't have to deal with Night Fight. Screw it.
I told you. Yeah. I need dinosaurs.
All Night Fight. All right. So because the whole defense now falls the Planetary Governor and her forces. And what happens next makes me really happy and really sad. And I'll explain in a minute. So the Admech facility is near to fall. So Governor Gallo decides to lead the defense herself. And she brings with her her very own Baneblade. And this is like my favorite thing, by the way, in all of the Imperial Guard. Like the actual Baneblade, by the way. Not the Banehammer, not the Bane Sword, the Dune Hammer. The Baneblade, which, by the way, should only have flamers. The heavy bolters are stupid.
How are you so pinkies out on which is the good super heavy tanks?
Because I can be.
Jesus.
The Bane, look, like, it's fine. Look, the Bane Hammer has its place. The Bane Sword has its place. The Doom Hammer is cool as hell. Don't get me wrong. But the Baneblade is just, that's your bread and butter right there. You're nice. It's beautiful. It's got, but again, you have to put the flamers on it because it's, God, that game, it is fun to play with. Just, it sucks on the tabletop. Anyway, looks awesome. What's funny is that, yeah, so she comes out with this Baneblade and the Baneblade goes brrr into the Necrons and just actually single-handedly shuts down the advance. The entire Necron, like a million Necrons just go, yeah, we got nothing. That's a Baneblade, which by the way is what a Baneblade should be able to do. It's awesome. And it's just rocking and rolling and having a grand old time until.
However,
yeah,
that I was just about to say, ugh. It probably should have shot the guy in charge.
Yeah, so Amintar then drops in from above into the middle of the Imperial forces like a blender and just starts shredding everybody. And unfortunately, the people inside the Baneblade did not include a commissar. So they didn't think to just fire on Amintar anyway, because, you know, they were worried they might kill the fellow guardsmen, which, by the way, I'm pretty sure is in the Imperial Primer you'd get killed for. Not the shooting the Imperial, the guardsmen, the not shooting the guardsmen to kill the bad guy. I'm pretty sure that actually gets you death in the Imperial Primer.
Well, you know what did get everybody death? The Skorpek Lord that burrowed into the Baneblade and went, hey, are any of you guardsmen able to take me on mano a mano in melee combat? By the way, the answer was no. Yeah. And the Skorpek Lord also asked everyone in the Baneblade because he killed everyone in the Baneblade.
But I do like the last thing the Imperial Defenders did was Governor Gallo then took out her sword and led a final charge into the Necron warriors.
Which did nothing.
Yeah. Nothing. By the way, that's all it is. They don't even describe what happens next. They just go, the last thing she did was took out her sword and charged. And there's no words after that. The story just moves on.
Because it was that ineffective.
All right. So the Necrons get to the ADMEC facility, which is locked, but they had 3 Doomsday arcs, so it stopped being locked.
Doomsday arcs versus door seems bad.
Yeah, it's like, oh, look, it's open now. And then when they get inside, there's a bunch of Skitarii defenders that Amintar just goes, yeah, that's cute. Nope. Slaughters all of them, finds Akht standing next to C-Tan Shard, and Akht is like, looks at Amintar.
By the way, this is so sad because he could have actually unlocked it because he was planning on anyways. Akht begs Amintar to unlock the shard so he can see his god. He just wants to lay. He knows he's going to die. Doesn't care. I just want to see him once. And Amintar goes, sure, man, I'm going to do that for you. Absolutely not. He did not say any of those things. Yeah. He instantly killed him.
It kills Akht and then opens the shard. And then
first kills Akht, then
opens the shard and then teleports away and literally leaves Nova Magnor. Just, I'm gone. Grabs the shard and disappears. Which a lot of you are like, well, what about Titus? This is kind of weird. This all is happening at the exact same time. So meanwhile, because again, like I said, Transformers, the TV show, which if you haven't seen, it was also good.
This is a big deal. Usually in the books and the stories, you get losses for the Imperium. This wasn't a loss. This was just a Necron slaughter fest.
The Necrons, they got there. But over on site Umbra, Titus and his force finally make it all the way back to the Great Hall where they got defeated before. And now Anutek, the woman we were talking about before, had been so focused on like this mix of offense on the planet that she actually hadn't really defended herself. She had a very small defensive force in the area because all the Necrons who were coming in, she was throwing at the Imperials. It's basically once the Tech Marines started like turning on the Vortex bomb that she didn't disassemble behind her, that she's like, oh crap. And she immediately breaks focus and attacks Titus and his crew. Blah, 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 fight, blah, blah, blah. Ultramarines get upper hand, blah, blah, blah. Necrons get upper hand, blah, blah, blah. Gadriel almost dies, but then Titus jumps in and fights Anutek.
In my mind, he did like a backflip and all kinds of stuff because he does fight through and he jumps over a bunch of people to do
to go and do this. And the whole thing is Anutek Anutek gets over. Come by the destroyer curse while fighting, so then she becomes sloppy, and because she's sloppy, Titus shoves a chainsword through her body, and then she teleports away to go heal somewhere else. So then Titus and his crew flip the switch in the vortex bomb, which explodes or implodes. So vortex bombs basically make the warp occur and then remove the warp. So it makes the materium become the immaterium and then removes the immaterium from the materium. They're really cool. And hopefully for 11th edition, they'll bring back the greatest rule and mission. It'd be so good.
Stop attacks are coming back.
Nothing good for knights. Knights don't deserve nice things. All right, but Titus and his crew then flee. This blows up the main site, and all the Necron reinforcements are gone. At the same time, Amintar is also gone. So the Imperial forces do reclaim Nova Magnor, sort of.
I mean, hold on. You're
they do reclaim it. It's just
Sure, it's but
the what's, it. The, yeah, it's the it wasn't what they started with. It's more like yeah. Oh, great.
I'm like, you just gave back. You went to
yeah,
what Team America World Police and went, you're welcome, France. when they yeah. saved Paris,
save Paris. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking about when they go, yeah. We've got Nova Monger back. You're like, kind of.
But yeah, so I'll be honest, when I got to the end of this book, it's kind of anticlimactic because Titus and Amintar both win. Amintar got his Nightbringer shard. And
which is Titus, all he wanted in the first place. Yeah.
Titus does secure Nova Magnor, what's left of it. But it's still a functioning planet. It's not like the whole, it got destroyed. He also got Idaris, what was left of that. And all for Ultramar. Some significant losses, but he got them. Now, but that's it. That's kind of the whole thing. There is some other stuff, though, that we probably should touch on really quick, because there's about 8 other pages and like 16 paragraphs what the other Tetrarchs were doing. And I like it because it's, as you guys know, I've listened to the show for a while, I like the Codex lore almost more than like the Black Library stuff because I find it fun to read. And so, well, we just touch on the other Tetrarchs real quick because there's not much to do. And these are fun tidbits. And we'll start with...
to be fair... This actually is the most important of the fronts. It's because it's got all the important shit.
Oh, the first one? All the
important planets.
Yeah. Conor? Yeah. So we'll start with Conor, which is Agamemnon, which I'm not even going to apologize for anymore. We're just going to keep calling him that.
Just, yeah, 100%.
Yeah, that's it. So Conor is the north of Ultramar. And this was destined to be the most successful for two reasons. One, Agamemnon is the captain of the first company. And this region has the highest percentage of imperial held planets. These are planets, they were under duress from a combo of heretics and orcs. Like there was actually an orc pirate kingdom in the middle of it called Stomping Grounds. Good job, orcs. Stomping, by the way, P-I-N. No G. There we go. Yeah. And Agamemnon.
Grounds with a Z.
Oh, yeah, with a Z, yeah. And Agamemnon does, all right, I have a plan. So there's a bunch of orc pirates and there's a bunch of heretics. Cool. Full court press. And just decides to go bring his entire chapter and all their forces and just start at one side and just go to the other at full speed. And he quells all of it. It's awesome.
And I love this. They give it the least amount of words, press in the books, but this is the most important part for the rest of the Imperium. It's not the coolest for the story because it's not the cool fighting, but you have to take this place. This is where all of the most populous planets that Agro Worlds, Hive World, there is a bunch of stuff that has to be taken. If you lost the rest of the fronts but kept this one, you still could fight.
Yeah.
This one is the most important.
So that part goes great. Yay, Agamemnon. The opposite side of this, though, is the Andermung front, which is Captain Porton of the Genesis chapter. He has Lieutenants Rutherford, Banks, and Phil Collins. So the Andermung front is tricky because the warp down there is just rough. So that's how they describe it, is the warp travel just not very reliable. So Porton can't do a full court press because all the forces would arrive at different times. So he has to go through like much more meticulously and one at a time. He also has to reinforce areas because once you leave an area, it's hard to get back to it. So you have to really have complete victories, then fully secure it, and then move on. So Porton's been moving much more slowly, but he has been moving methodically throughout the sector. Yeah. And his biggest problem is pirates.
It's pirates, but also the fact that the people there don't want to be part of.
Yeah.
I just saved you. No, you didn't. I don't want to be saved.
Yeah.
So
I'm good.
This is a real problem.
Yeah, it's funny. So he's got these two things. He's got orc freebooters and pirates. But the other one is, all the planetary governors are like, oh, no. But it's actually fun. The story is very funny in there because what they keep dealing with is, you show up as Ultramarines on a planet. The planetary governor really doesn't want to say no because, the whole dying thing. So what they do instead in the story is the local leaders would just put the delegations in waiting rooms with no food and just kept saying, hey, we're running 5 minutes late and would for like days. And what the delegates would leave until the Ultramarines would like, all right, well, we'll just send them with food. And so over time, Phil Collins and crew are bringing the worlds into the fold, but it's challenging. These worlds are resisting, not like actively resisting. They're just not actively complying is how I would describe it. So it's kind of a cool one. Then you go to the east with Captain Felix, who's basically, whereas Phil Collins and crew are dealing, I shouldn't call it that, because if you name it the Genesis chapter, I'm just going to do Phil Collins, dealing with it. But yeah, just sorry. But they're dealing with like kind of pirates and some resistance. Like, yeah, hey, it's a pain in the ass.
Yeah, but this is crazy.
Captain
from him.
Felix is on the other side of it. Like, oh no, I'm actually at war. Holy
with
crap.
Who? Yeah. Yes. Just yes.
Yeah. This is called the Vespator Front. This is Necron, Death Guard, Genius Leaders, and Leagues of Votan are all
here. Random League is here too.
Yeah. Yeah,
also, just letting you know, everyone is fighting everyone.
Yeah.
And looking for the opportunity for anybody that helps in any fight to attack them as soon as that happens.
Yeah. So Felix decides to do the Agamemnon thing. He just goes, all right, let's just full court press, mass strike, hard and fast, everybody. And at first, he's having a good amount of success. But, this is the early stages, is what they basically refer to. It's like the first few worlds he goes into, no problem. Everyone's in full retreat. But he hasn't gotten to the rougher parts yet, like the worlds where you have Necron flayed ones fighting Poxwalkers.
What do you even do with that world? Yeah, just go, let's just blow this place up.
Just move on.
This neighborhood's value has went so down.
You also have Votan, which makes sense because of where Ultramar is. Votan have now arrived, and they're basically stealing the resources from some of the planets. That's what they're doing. It's Votan pirates. I mean, they're not pirates, but they're referring to them as if they're pirates, have come in like, oh, there's a bunch of resources on that planet. Yeah. I'm going to take those now. No. Like, yeah. Watch me. And because Votan, when they come in force, so you have to fight Votan. And of course, there's gene stealers, because there's always gene stealers. And the last one is the Doom Eagles. It's just the Western region. This is Captain Balthus. I don't like the name. That's all right. Doom Eagles is just a dumb name. I'm sorry. He's the same problem Phil Collins has. The region's just problematic, but it's always problematic. The difference is this region, it seems to always just fall apart. So worlds will go to compliance and then they fall out of compliance. Yeah. All the explorers who go there, they go missing. And to the point where even just the level of uprisings, there's just a cause there. This is not normal anti-imperial. And
I'm jumping on this because he just chooses out of the options you could have chose. The Ultramarines do such a great job of, we're going to bolster the life. We're going to make you safe. We're going to get
you better. It's a successor chapter.
And instead he's like, I will beat you with a stick until you're happy. And you're like, but you had so many great options. He's like, yeah, I got this stick though. Yeah. That I'm going to hit you with until you tell me that you're super happy to be hit with the stick.
Yeah. He goes with the age old, the beatings will continue until morale improves. What? That is his actual plan here. And just goes forcing compliance in the region with just absolute might of the Imperium. Just devastating worlds, killing Imperial governors. Basically saying, you think other stuff's scary? There's nothing scarier than an angry space marine. Which, honestly isn't that
kind of work. Yeah. Except for he used the, I got mind control over Debo.
Yeah.
Because as soon as they leave, they talk again.
But the real problem with the region is the region is full of heretics. And it's full of Drukhari activity. So that's one of the, so it's just this whole region's a mess. So he's getting pulled around. Now, that being said, though, with all that, the Tetrarchs are all doing pretty well. I mean, Protoss and Andermung Fronts are moving more slowly than Vespator and Kronor, but they're doing well. Titus is really the only one who actually had a bad time. And so overall, 500 Worlds campaign is going pretty well. Gilliman's plan of expanding Ultramar and improving the resources for the Imperium, I wouldn't call it A+, but pretty good. And so it's great. But what about the Necrons? And this is a bit more interesting to me. And we're going to spend some time on this real quick. The Silent King is unfortunately pretty busy right now. Amon-Tar was successful in getting another Nightbringer shard. But this time, he attacked the Saltek tomb world. And a major tomb world. That was of great significance to the Saltek dynasty.
Also, it's a big deal because the other Necrons now found out that he could force Destroyer Curse on people, because when he captured people, he was using his cryptex to infect them, not just from his aura and him personally, but he was turning people over. And this is terrifying to the people that are sentient, the overlords and everything else,
right,
that, oh, this could be a real problem for me. Because before, the Destroyer Curse is this thing that happens to lesser beings and whatnot, and it probably won't get around to me. I could get in the middle of this fight. All of a sudden, I'm effectively a drone,
yep, you know,
slave to the Destroyer Curse. And that's a big deal.
Yeah, and what you have now is that up until this point, Amon-Tar has gone largely ignored by the Silent King. Nothing goes unnoticed by the Silent King, but they just take priority. Now, the Silent King is a little bit jammed up right now. He is stuck in the Pariah Nexus. He's pinned between the encroaching forces of Gilliman and a civil war with the Sautek dynasties and the Imhotek. But the Sautek dynasty just had some little bit of an issue here. Right? Silent King needs to secure that sector and his forces so he can move forward in the galaxy. But this creates a bit of a plot challenge more for the game. Now, this is why I'm excited about this. For a decade or so, GW has been giving the Necrons a glow up, starting about the 8th edition, I think it's about the 8th edition Codex, where they went from mindless murder robots that wanted to extinguish all life to a complex Xeno species with like disparate goals, abilities, etc. And at that time, I think it was the 8th edition Codex, but it might have been the 9th edition Codex, they basically implied that the Necrons are massively more numerous than originally hinted. Kind of like with the Votann recently, where they're like, oh, by the way, there's more Votann than members of the Imperium. Like, wait, what? That's a thing? All right, cool. And so it's implied in the writings, it may have even been overtly, I can't remember, that if the Necrons fully awaken, they actually could overtake the galaxy because they would outnumber, I'm not sure they would outnumber humanity, but they would outgun humanity by a wide margin. Then unfortunately, the Silent King comes back as M42, and that just happened. Like, the Necrons are awakening in mass right now. So GW's in a bit of a bind. GW has the Necrons fully awakening. So are they going to conquer the galaxy? And now, it's what I'm excited about, they've added a wrinkle. And the wrinkle is Imhotek and Amon-Tar. A massive potential civil war within the Necrons that could engulf them and kind of prevent their rise to power. So this is something I want to kind of discuss.
Well, it's such a big deal on that, because Imhotek straight up backstabbed the Silent King, because he waited until...
I mean, it was a front stab, if I'm being honest. It wasn't even et tu, Brute, because there was no one else. It was just Brute, what the... You
know, true.
WTF, I mean, Brute.
It is a big deal, because he decided, hey, I noticed that you were fully involved in combat. Okay, here it comes.
You know? Yeah, I'm going to come attack you. And so this actually gets... To me, this is really cool, because it does, it helps. I like seeing... GW does a really good thing in their writing on occasion. They do not like to retcon. We talked about this before. They go out of their way to not retcon. And sometimes they do a better job than others. But this is one scenario where I'm really happy. They were heading down a path where they were going to put themselves in this tough bind of, okay, the Necrons are fully awakening. Okay, so they win. Now we've got this Destroyer Curse. Destroyer Curse means that now the Necrons have to fight that. And they have, and this Imhotek split also is there. This also potentially sets us up for the Tyranids. Because one of the complaints I have is we get towards the end of 10th edition. So I don't know when you're listening to this, but if you're listening to this, you know, in before middle of 2026,
June 2026.
I'm still accurate. But if it's after June 2026, sorry. But what I like about this is that I've been struggling in that I feel like we're getting to a point of like almost a Warhammer fantasy where the galaxy is just kind of done. We've got the Rift has split the galaxy in half, which I think was too much. There's Tyranids engulfing the entire galaxy, which I again,
which we
I
haven't done jack about.
No, they did one thing. They stopped the one tendril coming towards Sol.
Sure, but
and then I they mean, and then what's it? Inquisitor Crypman shoved the orcs into the other one.
There's some real Tyranid problems that we just kind of story-wise went, we'll figure that out later. You're like, you guys said they were about to collapse the galaxy.
Exactly. And also the Necrons are about to collapse the galaxy. And the Rift has split the galaxy in half. And, well...
Abaddon's still pushing pretty hard, by the way.
Yeah, and that's what this all comes into. So it's kind of what I'm hoping. The Necrons actually, to me... I mean, man, I am going to be so wrong on this. But the Necrons, to me... give GW a great plot out. First off, the Necrons have the Blackstone. So they actually can close the Rift, or maybe not close it, at least shrink the rift.
They need to control the rift. Yeah. The rift was a cool thing of Chaos is starting to win and, and push their
But we both agree.
It was, scheme forward.
It was a mistake.
It's just
the writing. Yeah, the writing of it was a mistake because it's like, so there's a giant hole into the immaterial
galaxy. I think they always had the Necrons were going to shut that. Remember, they right away had that little blurb of the Necrons trying to saying that they could just close the rift.
Yeah, so, but that's what has to happen. So that nicely, the Necrons have the ability to close the rift. Also, the Necrons, fan theory, the Tyranids are the old ones. So Necrons and old ones, that's a fun fight. Put those two into each other, kind of brings that one down. The Necrons start to solve a lot of the problems for the galaxy.
Because they can blunt the Tyranids force and they can blunt the Chaos problem. And then we get back to the galaxy isn't just collapsing.
Exactly. And at the same time, while they do those two blunts, they take massive losses, which brings them down to away from a race that just easily conquers the galaxy and becomes. I mean, so this is my hope. I don't know if GW listens to this. I have geolocation on people who listen to this cast. I can't see down to that close, but there's listeners in Nottingham. But anyway, ha ha ha. So, but with that, that's the end of kind of our coverage of 500 Worlds for now. Next week, we're going to finally do something that I've been getting yelled at on Discord to do for a while. Ew. Come on, Brad, get excited.
The Queen of Slime. Yeah,
they're big. They're bronze, and you really don't want them showing up. The Minotaurs. We're going to cover the Space Marine faction that Brad probably likes. Well, I don't think you like them the least. It's a weird scenario. I think you like the Minotaur faction a lot.
I like the Minotaur faction
a
lot.
You just hate.
It's just us doing this as doing a cast on them means I have to go in to people, specifically the Lords of Terra, that I hate. And that's who made these guys happen.
Yeah.
So we have to spend a bunch of time on that as opposed to just going, Minotaurs do cool stuff.
Maybe we'll just do the first episode only on Lords of Terra. Just a whole episode on like.
I will punch you.
We both know. Like, honestly, at this point, you just hurt yourself.
I mean, I did leave the house for my first time yesterday and instantaneously fell out of a car.
Yeah. So. I like my odds. But all right. With that, John Barsotti, Brad Chester.
This guy.
See you guys next week.